Say the word sleek out loud to yourself. Now say the word out loud again, but this time elongate the E sound. What comes to mind? What mental picture forms? Some animals are sleek, a cheetah for instance, or a weasel. Can you picture a fat ferret? I didn't think so. Sleek is just one of those words where meaning and sound combine and then complement each other. Do you know any people who are genuinely sleek? Certainly it's becoming harder and harder to find them, although they stand out much more than they would have even a decade ago. I think that being sleek probably was always more important to women than to men, maybe because it gave them so many fashion options. You've all seen models strutting along fashion show runways. Now, those women are sleek. Joanne was sleek. Other girls envied her for it. They would say things like, "Oh, Joey." They're just between girls nickname for her. "You're so lucky. You can wear anything, and it always looks good on you." The problem was that Joanne didn't want to be sleek. Joanne hated sleek. Joanne wanted to look more like Joanne than Joey. But her body seemed oblivious in that regard, and her lack of curves seemed to create the impression in many that she was a tomboy, which she was, but mostly because others expected her to be. Yes, she was athletic. She played boy sports, like baseball and basketball, and was respected for her skill in both. She excelled at track and field competitions and won ribbons and medals, which she had once displayed proudly, but now hid away. She had the legs and stamina of a long-distance runner, but didn't like long-distance running and the loneliness that defined it. She especially hated that some kids still referred to her as Stick or The Stick. She could thank her mother for that. Back in first grade, around the holidays, her teacher, Mrs. Lyons, concerned that Joanne and her class were still traumatized by events 1 year before, when Santa had permanently spirited away their kindergarten teacher to the North Pole, hit upon the idea of a Christmas costume party to entertain and distract the troops. She needn't have bothered, because the troops had only the vaguest memories of Miss Dooley's dying swan act, the Milk Money Girl's screams, or Mr. Knight's shit. In any case, the party was on, and first-grade mothers did their best to humiliate their children, all in the Christmas spirit. Joanne's mom, Joyce, capitalizing on Joanne's slim build, constructed a cardboard peppermint stick with an open bottom for legs, armholes for arms, eye holes for, well, you get it, and a curved top, which caused Joanne to walk in left-handed circles when she wasn't correcting for her list. From that time forward, Joanne was Stick, mostly among those many who envied her intelligence, which was somewhere between brilliant and genius. Her mother advised patience. Joyce had a nature will provide mindset, but to Joanne, nature didn't seem interested in providing, and Joanne soon decided to take matters into her own hands. She tried eating more in the hope that fat would go to her hips and not to her stomach. However, the fat didn't go to either, and stuffing herself made her feel lazy and lethargic. She tried isometric exercises to fill out her bust, but her breast remained what guys derisively referred to as mosquito bites. When her friends went shopping with their mothers for training bras, Patsy called them slingshots, she went to Vincent's Shoes to buy a new pair of sneakers. She even began to fear that people would assume that she was experiencing some sort of developmental delay, or that, even worse, she'd turn out to be a lesbian. God forbid.
The Fab Four were no help. The one time they'd acknowledged her as a girl was when they'd asked about periods, and she'd gotten all upset because she still hadn't started hers when all of her friends had. Once the dust settled from that, they went right back to treating her like one of the guys.
It would have been nice if Joanne could have looked to her mother for support, but she knew it simply wouldn't be forthcoming. That was because Joanne's grandfather on her mother's side was a respected attorney who wanted very much to add "and son" to his shingle and stationery. But Joanne's mom was an only child, and prospects for additional offspring ended with her birth. As a result, Joanne's mom grew up trying to be the boy her father had really wanted.
Like Joanne, she excelled equally in athletics and academics, and even eventually took her law degree, which was very unusual back in the day.
When her father became a judge, Joanne's mom inherited her grandfather's law practice and even expanded it.
People called her ambitious, and although it was sometimes meant to be derogatory, she treated it as a compliment.
Respect from the public, and especially her peers, was everything to her. Motherhood, fashion, and personal appearance took a back seat.
Her clothes closet was divided into business suit frump and casual frump, and makeup was restricted to lipstick and a little rouge.
This, however, doesn't mean to say that she was neglectful as a wife or a mother. She wasn't.
Her husband and her daughter simply didn't engage her in the same way that her profession did.
She sometimes felt guilty about that, but not for long. She was just one of those people set on dedicating her life to meeting her father's expectations, continuing even after her father's only remaining judgment was the one St. Peter would pass on him. Joanne had to find support elsewhere.
She couldn't look to her dad, who was pretty much oblivious to most things female. It's not that she was estranged from him, but intimacy with his daughter,
and with his wife for that matter,
would never be his strong suit. Their only common ground was Joanne's athletic accomplishments.
Joanne also didn't actively pursue girly girl status, as did some of her friends who had developed earlier than she had, but she didn't want to be a gender-neutral sounding board for the Fab Four where feminine topics were concerned either. She knew they didn't set out to make her feel like that, but she had. She had other girls who were friends, but she didn't have any girlfriends, if that makes any sense.
She felt alone, even in company.
Especially in company.
Her salvation finally arrived in a totally unexpected way when John privately asked her if she'd mind meeting with his older sister, Ruth, because...
she wants to ask you something.
Ruth Damien was abroad, but a classy one. The difference, according to Ruth herself, was one of looks and style, and most importantly, attitude. She abhorred passivity in either gender. She was 6 years older than John.
Each had different fathers. Both marriages had failed. They had both spent most of their lives in a single-parent setting.
Ruth's dad was a machinist who had died in an industrial accident, while John's dad was career military. Both kids had been raised on a string of army bases, John from birth and Ruth from the age of four. Every time their dad was reassigned,
which was frequently,
Ruth and John would need to play catch-up in a new school. The result for both was a lot of disruption where learning was concerned.
Ruth's mom and dad had rented a place in Enfield, which was only about 3 miles from Bradley Field, where he was stationed with the Air National Guard at the time.
When he got reassigned, her mom followed him to his new assignment in Texas, where they lived on the base. But they decided to keep paying for Ruth and John to live in the rented house for a while so that the kids could at least make it through high school.
John had partially overcome the academic handicap, but Ruth never did. She chose to drop out of high school at the start of what would have been her junior year and completed her learning at Miss Evelyn's School of Fashion, Hairdressing, Cosmetology, Carriage, and Deportment. She now worked as a hairdresser, and she was good at making others look their best. Naturally, her expertise extended to herself. Her clothes were provocative, but not sexy. Her makeup was impeccable.
Ruth wasn't book smart, but she was streetwise and clever.
She'd broken several hearts, but her own was largely unaffected up to now.
In short, Ruth was a formidable and desirable young woman with a strong independent streak.
Some months back, Ruth had met and started dating a handsome Greek named Demetrius, who worked as a butcher in the supermarket his father owned. It wasn't long before they started talking about spending their lives together, but there was a complication.
Demetrius's parents were from the old country, which meant that Demetrius had to get his father's blessing before proceeding, which was only right because the young couple had to turn to his parents to foot the bill for the wedding and reception, Ruth's mom not being able to contribute much more than a wedding present.
Demetrius's father said that he wouldn't give money or his blessing until he could tell his friends, and more importantly, his relatives, that his future daughter-in-law had at least graduated from high school. And that's what Ruth wanted to talk to Joanne about.
Ruth wanted Joanne to tutor her for the GED.
The meeting took place at her and John's house, where Ruth explained her circumstances. She also explained that it just made sense that she should ask Joanne for help, as they already knew each other casually, being virtual neighbors, and because Joanne had already built a reputation as an exceptional scholar, especially where math and science were concerned.
The areas where Ruth felt most deficient.
And that their meetings could be conducted with discretion.
As Demetrius would simply break both arms of any one of Joanne's or John's friends who couldn't keep their mouths shut.
Naturally, Joanne was rather reticent, but when Ruth showed her some books about the GED that John had liberated from the library, Joanne was much reassured. Still, she explained that she would test Ruth frequently on GED-equivalent materials to ensure her progress, and she would tell Ruth immediately if she, Joanne, felt that she had taken Ruth as far as she could. She also made it clear that she couldn't guarantee results because she could only control the teaching end and not the learning part. Ruth accepted that.
When it came to the subject of payment, rather than negotiate dollars and cents, Joanne proposed that Ruth teach her in return about how she could become more womanly in dress, appearance, and behavior.
In other words, how to do more with what she had.
Ruth knew she could. And with that, the deal was sealed.
They met once a week at Joanne's house. Joanne started with a review of what Ruth had covered in her freshman and sophomore classes, and both were pleasantly surprised at how much Ruth had retained.
Also, the fact that Ruth had taken both math and science during those 2 years, and the school system only required 3 years of each for graduation, meant that Joanne's teaching and Ruth's learning were facilitated even more.
Ruth kept her part of the bargain by helping Joanne choose a complementary foundation and blush, then moving on to eye enhancement, where they experimented with false lashes, mascara, shadow, liner, etc., etc., etc. Joanne was surprised by the options available and the variety of effects they produced.
By the time they were ready to tackle Algebra 2, they had moved on to hairdressing, and plane geometry opened the door to posture in sitting, standing, and walking.
Ruth also helped Joanne to choose a scent and told her never to use the word perfume because it would make Joanne sound common. She called Joanne's choice of scent her signature.
Although they were usually finished and Ruth had left when Joanne's mom came home, outside of a comment about Joanne's room smelling like the cosmetics counter at JCPenney's, the attorney showed little interest. And the only time the Fab Four missed Joanne was when they needed somebody to fill out the infield for an impromptu after-school baseball game.
When word started to spread about the upcoming semi-formal dance, the junior high prom, Ruth took Joanne on a field trip to the Marnell shop, Frenchtown's go-to place for proms, weddings, mothers-of-the-bride dresses, first communion outfits, etc.
Joanne at first protested that she hadn't even been asked to the dance, but Ruth seemed confident that she would be, so Joanne deferred to Ruth's experience in such matters.
While Joanne picked out and tried on several dresses that her mother would certainly have approved, Ruth wasn't satisfied with the admittedly conservative selection, so they left. When Joanne hesitated to shop elsewhere, Ruth said, "Do you want to be Joey in a party dress, or do you want to become Joanne?"
The question was decidedly rhetorical, so Joanne said nothing.
Ruth said, "I want you to meet somebody."
Lenore Gambrini had an interesting reputation going back to World War II when it was rumored that she was a victory girl. That is, a woman who contributed to the war effort by entertaining the troops when they were home on leave. Whether or not that reputation was deserved could never be proven, because servicemen were frequently known to exaggerate their conquests, mostly to their fellows, and hometown Plain Janes saw Lenore as an easy target for jealous snipes when men in uniform passed them over.
Lenore, confident of her combined sex appeal and business acumen, simply ignored them, which, of course, infuriated her critics even more.
Which, of course, was Lenore's intention.
Rumors about her possibly prurient interests persisted even to the present, however, with some even convinced that she had a special back room where sex toys and dominatrix supplies were displayed. Of course, no one had actually seen it.
Although they swore they would never set foot in Chez Lenore, once the bloom was off the rose for many marriages, Lenore's critics would often discreetly use the shop's rear entrance to check out the stock of Fredericks of Hollywood girdles, bustiers, torpedo tits bras, crotchless panties, etc.
Always first, having ensured that none of the cars in the shop's parking lot looked familiar.
Lenore was always busiest when she opened at 1.
I'll get there before anybody else.
Or just before she closed at 9.
I'll go now because everybody's probably already left.
Housewives trying to resuscitate their marriage ensured Lenore a steady income.
When Ruth pulled into Lenore's parking lot, Joanne almost bolted for home, but Ruth assured her that she did much of her own shopping there and knew Lenore well. Ruth led the way in, and sure enough, Lenore greeted her with a hug.
Joanne's first impression of Lenore was of a woman her mother would have called
mutton dressed up as a lamb.
Lenore may not have been a spring chicken, but she dressed, spoke, and more importantly, acted like a lady 20 years younger. Even Joanne had to give her credit for keeping the years at bay.
The only thing that gave Lenore away was the faint odor of Johnson's baby powder, which Joanne associated with her grandma.
Ruth explained that they were looking for a dress which would fill Joanne out a bit.
Enhance her attributes, in other words.
Said Lenore.
Exactly.
Ruth replied.
But it should be elegant, too. Did you bring her heels? Lenore asked as she started to sort through a rack and pull out several dresses. Right here, said Ruth. I'm loaning her a pair of mine.
At which point Ruth produced a pair of black high heels from a bag which Joanne hadn't noticed before.
Joanne obediently began trying dresses on, feeling almost surreal about the whole process. Eventually, the choice narrowed down to one of Lenore's more conservative outfits. A cream-colored blouse and a floor-length slit skirt that fit Joanne perfectly, creating just the effect they wanted, and rendered just slightly untraditional by its color, a beautiful shade of red dubbed Deep Rose on the tag.
Both ladies pronounced this outfit the one. Ruth asked Lenore to put it aside, explaining that they'd be back to pay for it. Then she and Joanne said their goodbyes.
After tackling the quadratic equation at their next scheduled session, Joanne and Ruth tackled the prom dress issue.
Joanne was having second thoughts about the choice of colors, knowing that most girls would be in pastels. Ruth said,
Look, Joey, I've shown you how to sit in a skirt so you're not flashing Tom, Dick, and Harry. I've shown you how to stand like a model with one foot slightly in front of the other. And I've shown you how to shift your weight when you walk so that you don't look like you're getting ready to play third base. The dress looks amazing on you. It says,
I'm more than just one of the guys.
Trust me. With that dress, your hair up, and my makeup, you will be stunning. I promise. Joanne asked, Do I really need to wear high heels? Nobody will see them.
Ruth responded,
Miss Evelyn says that high heels shift your center of gravity so that your chest sticks out in front and your butt sticks out in back, and that's what we want. We want sleek, but not flat. As Lenore said, enhance your attributes, right?
Joanne nodded.
Now, tell your mother that we picked out a dress and you need the money to pay for it. If she doesn't like it when you try it on for her, she can always return it and take you shopping herself.
Joanne said,
I'll have to return it anyway if nobody asks me. I don't even have a date yet.
Ruth, looking mysteriously smug, responded by saying,
Oh, you will.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Frenchtown. Remember that new episodes drop on Mondays at midnight, so please continue to join us. Frenchtown was written and produced by Jim Gatto. The principal readers are Dana Schatz and Jeffrey Anbinder. The technical director is David Keith. Introductory and playout music was written and performed by Lisa Spike Norman. Whoever You Are and I'm Coming Home Again were written by Jim Gatto. It's Almost Tomorrow was also written by Jim Gatto based on an idea from Lorraine Nelson. Additional musical recording was provided by Chrissy Gardner, Ryan Gardner, Gracie Price, and Megan Keith. The Frenchtown graphic design is courtesy of Carolyn Komerska. Special thanks go to associate producer Kathy Keith and to Lorraine Nelson, Stephanie Levine, and Elaine Bissette. Frenchtown is a fictionalized memoir. Although some of the places mentioned existed at one time, they are either gone now or vastly different from what they were over 60 years ago. The characters are composites of friends and relatives I once knew, but they were not modeled on individuals who actually existed. Any resemblance to people or places is unintentional and coincidental. The entire contents of Frenchtown is copyrighted. For further information about Frenchtown and its contributors, please send inquiries to frenchtowninfo@gmail.com. ¶¶
gonna take it, gonna hold it, gonna make it love me, steal your heart everywhere. Gonna take you on a little ride, gonna take you on a little ride. Put your hand in mine, you'll be fine, soon you will touch the sky, take you on a little ride, yeah. I'm gonna love you, gonna kiss you, gonna hold you, gonna miss you, gonna love you all night and all day. Take it, gonna hold it, I'm gonna make you love me, gonna steal your heart away. Say it again, I'm gonna steal your heart away. One more time, I'm gonna steal your heart away.